a modern metropolis is starting to take form, the likes of which we recognize today. And then along comes this really well-positioned and very powerful storm that comes to be known as the Great Storm of 1915.
One of the things I really like about this column of yours is there's a bit of a hero, Isaac M. Klein. Tell us about him.
Isaac Klein is a fascinating figure. He's the nation's premier meteorologist and storm forecaster. And he earned his fame and some would say his infamy from the terribly tragic 1900 storm in Galveston, where he was the chief forecaster there. And that took the city by surprise at the cost of 6,000 lives. By this time, by 1915, he is in the newly opened U.S. Post Office, which is now the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And he is tracking the storm as reports are coming in from sailors. Keep in mind, this is before any sort of aerial surveying, much less satellite.
And so he surmises a big storm is coming. He's done some research. What are his analytics for this? You mentioned sailors. How else did he collect data?
Through field stations, reports from sailors coming in through telephone or telegraph. And there's one scene where Klein actually records this in a remarkable document that I found a few years ago. He has local news reporters in his office, and he learns of people living out in the Wrigleys in Lake Catherine who are largely unaware. At the time, the Wrigley's was filled with these hunting and fishing camps, so they had guests out there. And they were largely unaware that this hurricane is about to strike.
This is kind of on the eastern edge of the city, right?
Exactly.
Who does he get in touch with over there to let these people know?
Gets in touch with a man by the name of Manuel Marquez, who's the caretaker for one of these hunting and fishing clubs, the Angler Club it was called. He has his entire extended family out there. They live out there, as well as anywhere from 25 to 45 guests. Klein encourages him in the most forceful words that he recorded to hail down the next train. I want to point out that when hurricanes approached in this era, people did not evacuate from New Orleans. They evacuated to New Orleans. So denizens of rural coastal areas headed toward the safety of the city. So Klein is encouraging Marquez to gather up everyone, and if the train doesn't stop coming in from Mobile heading to New Orleans, well, put a tie on the track and force it to stop. So Marquez waves down a train, the Mobile Limited, and to his surprise, the train does in fact stop. But now he has to encourage or convince the worried engineer. Keep in mind that the passenger car is filled with these very apprehensive passengers. Why have we stopped? There's surge coming in. And he begs for time to go and gather all his charges and all his family. The engineer makes a decision that we simply can't wait that long. The surge is coming up. And so they head into New Orleans. And tragically, after the storm passes, 43 people died. Violent deaths, drowning in the Wrigley's in Lake Catherine, one of the highest concentrations of hurricane-related deaths in the city's history.
And what was the strategy of heading to New Orleans? Why was that the emergency preparedness of the day?
People in the 18th and 19th century in New Orleans generally did not worry about hurricane storm surges in the city. We were buffered by a much healthier apron of wetlands and swamps that buffered this incoming surge. But things are just beginning to change around 1915. It's also protected by levees, or so we thought. There were some breaches. But basically, big, sturdy public buildings such as schools and civic buildings formed the places of refuge.
I love your use of some of the newspaper headlines in this story. Can you remember a few of those?
City stormproof, I think one goes. This defiant tone, as we've proved to the world. And I wouldn't quite go so far to say it was a stormproof, but it was a lot more buffered and protected than it is today. And so I see of the Great Storm of 1915 as sort of this first modern hurricane storm surge disaster here, when we start to see the processes that lead to the more severe flooding in 1947, 1965, and of course 10 years ago, as those environmental surroundings started to deteriorate.
Did the headlines change post-storm?
Well, you know, they reported the death toll was like 275. More than 15 or 20% of them were in the Wrigley. So it was sufficiently catastrophic. We have markers of this to this day. About 11 churches lost their steeples, which speaks to the ferocity of the wind. This was at least a Category 4 storm, and it positioned New Orleans in that dreaded northeastern quadrant. So imagine if Katrina arrived more to the west, which would have been worse for us. And imagine if it had arrived as the category 4 or 5 that it was previously. And that's how the 1915 storm arrived. Yet less flooding because more wetlands.
That's my new favorite storm metric, loss of steeples.
Yes.
Did this change the city's storm approach at all in any way, kind of moving forward?
It did indeed. In the subsequent years, people are moving more and more into places like Lakeview and Gentilly in the spirit of protecting these areas from a storm surge coming in for Lake Pontchartrain. An 1870s plan to shore up the lakefront was revived and actually built in the 1920s and 1930s, creating our present-day lakefront. Sediment was dredged from the bottom of Lake Pontchartrain and brought into a cofferdam to create higher land there. And a lot of people think that this was for residential reasons and it created new parks and amenities. But first and foremost, it was for flood protection.
Any details you want to add?
Well, I'll point out this very interesting case of Leland University, which was this black college formed right after the Civil War in the heart of Uptown between Tulane and Carrollton, right where Newcomb Place is today. And it was built there, a little beautiful little campus in the 1870s. But what was going on by the early 1900s was that property values had skyrocketed here and it became the most prosperous neighborhood in the city. And so there was what we would call today gentrification pressure. The storm hit, it damaged the building, and that created an opportunity to go ahead, cash out, sell it for residential development, and Leland College became Leland University and moved north of Baton Rouge and eventually folded in 1960.
History repeats itself.
You could say that.
Rich Campanella is a geographer with the Tulane School of Architecture and the author of the Cityscapes column for NOLA.com, The Times-Picayune. Thanks again, Rich.
You're welcome, and thank you.